Saying it so doesn't make it so. Today's decision to grant former presidents criminal immunity reshapes the institution of the presidency. It makes a mockery of the principle, foundation to our Constitution and system of government, that no man is above the law. Relying on little more than its own misguided wisdom about the need for presidents to act fearlessly and, quote, bold and taking, quote, bold and unhesitating action, the court gives former President Trump all the immunity he asked for and more. Because our Constitution does not shield a former president from answering for criminal and treasonous acts, I, with Justice Kagan and Jackson, dissent. Remember the indictment. It paints a stark portrait of a president desperate to stay in power. In the weeks leading up to January 6, 2001, then President Trump allegedly, quote, spread lies that there had been outcome determinative fraud in the election and that he had actually won, close quote, despite being notified repeatedly by his own closest advisors that his claims were untrue. When dozens of courts swiftly rejected those claims, Trump allegedly, quote, pushed officials in certain states to ignore the popular vote, disenfranchise millions of voters, and dismiss legitimate electors, close quote. When state officials repeatedly declined to act outside their legal authority and alter their state election processes, Trump and his co-conspirators purportedly developed a plan to disrupt and displace the legitimate election certification process by organizing fraudulent slates of electors. As the date of the certification proceeding neared, Trump allegedly sought to, you, quote, use the power and authority of the Justice Department, close quote, to bolster his knowingly false claims of election fraud through sham election crime investigations and official letters falsely presenting the fraudulent electors as a valid alternative to the legitimate electors. When the department refused to do as he asked, Trump turned to the vice president. After he tried and failed to persuade the vice president, quote, to use his ceremonial role at the January 6 certification proceedings to fraudulently alter the election results, close quote, he allegedly, quote, attempted to use a crowd of supporters that he had gathered in Washington, D.C. to pressure the vice president to fraudulently alter the election results, again, close quote. Speaking to that crowd on January 6, Trump, quote, falsely claimed that based on fraud, the vice president could alter the outcome of the election results, close quote. When the crowd then violently attacked the Capitol and halted the proceedings, Trump allegedly delayed in taking any step to rein in the chaos he had unleashed. Instead, it is alleged in the indictment that he attempted to exploit the violence and chaos at the Capitol by pressuring lawmakers to delay the certification of the election and ultimately declare him the winner. This is the backdrop against which this case comes to the court. The majority notes that this criminal prosecution of a former president for his conduct in office is unprecedented. That's true. But it fails to recognize in any way that the events alleged in the indictment are also unprecedented. It is only because of those events that now this court confronts a question it has never had to answer in the nation's history: whether a former president enjoys immunity from federal criminal prosecution. The majority thinks he should, and so it invents an atypical, ahistorical, and unjustifiable immunity that puts the president above the law. The majority makes three moves that, in effect, completely insulate presidents from criminal liability. First, the majority creates absolute immunity for the president's exercise of, quote, core constitutional powers, close quote, as defined by the majority, not by anybody else. Despite that Trump has never sought this narrower immunity, and despite the fact that it rightly has no application in this case. Second, the majority eclipsed that concept of, quote, core, close quote, immunity with a much broader presumptive or absolute immunity for all of a president's official acts. The upshot is that a president's use of any official power for any purpose, even the most corrupt purpose, is now almost certain to be immune from prosecution. Third and finally, out of whole cloth, and it doesn't mention it today, the majority declares that evidence concerning acts for which the president is immune cannot be used against him in a criminal proceeding, even in a prosecution for private acts. Argument by argument, the majority invents immunity through brute force. Under its scrutiny, its arguments crumble. Indeed, all of the standard grounds for constitutional decision-making cut against the immunity that the majority creates today. Start with the text of the Constitution. It contains no provision for immunity from criminal prosecution for former presidents. That omission is not dispositive, but it is notable. The framers clearly knew how to provide for immunity from prosecution. They provided a narrow immunity for legislators in the speech or debate clause. And they knew that some state constitutions at the time specifically provided express criminal immunities to governors. Yet they noted no immunity for the president. And insofar as the Constitution's text speaks to the question at hand, it actually contemplates some form of criminal liability for former presidents by noting that a president who violates the law can, quote, be liable and subject to indictment, trial, judgment, and punishment according to law. Those are the words of the Constitution. The historical evidence also cuts against the majority. In the Federalist Papers, Alexander Hamilton promised that former presidents, unlike the kings that the framers had rejected, would be, quote, liable to prosecution and punishment in the ordinary course of law, close quote. At the Constitutional Convention, James Madison's proposal, quote, to consider what privileges ought to be allowed to the executive, was met with silence. And the delegates to the ratification debates made clear that the president would be, quote, punishable by the laws of his country, close quote. Interesting. History matters, right? Except here. In the same manner, the majority ignores overwhelming evidence that both presidents and the Justice Department have long understood former presidents to be answerable to the criminal law for their official acts. Take Washington, for example. After the Watergate tapes revealed President Nixon's misuse of official power to obstruct the FBI's investigation of the Watergate burglary, President Ford pardoned President Nixon. Both Ford's pardon and Nixon's acceptance of it necessarily rested on the understanding that the former president faced potential criminal liability. Subsequent special counsel and independent counsel investigations, such as the investigation of the Iran-Contra affair, have also operated on the assumption that the government can criminally prosecute former presidents for their official acts. Indeed, even Trump's own lawyers, during his second impeachment trial, were sure that a former president, I'm quoting their words, is like any other citizen and can be tried in a court of law, close quote. They promised senators that declining to convict Trump for his conduct related to January 6 would not leave him, quote, in any way above the law, close quote. Those are the words of Trump's own lawyers. In other words, the notion that a former president would be immune from a federal criminal prosecution had never occurred to the framers, to any sitting president, to the Justice Department, or until this case, to Trump's lawyers and to this court. Undeterred, the majority insists that the Constitution requires criminal immunity for former presidents. Never mind that Congress has a constitutional interest in enacting criminal laws that apply to everyone, and never mind that the judiciary has a constitutional duty to do justice in criminal prosecutions. According to the majority, separation of power principles demand criminal immunity for former presidents. The majority says that if a particular prosecution for a president's official acts would pose, quote, no dangers of intrusion on the authority and functions of the executive branch, close quote, listen to the words, none at all, then maybe, just maybe, it could move forward. But if this prosecution for allegedly attempting to subvert the results of a presidential election does not easily and obviously clear that bar, and according to the majority, it does not, then it is hard to imagine what prosecution ever will. So how does this majority get to its rule? Apart from its vague invocations of separation of power principles, the majority points to the balancing test this court employed in Nixon versus Fitzgerald. There, the court balanced the constitutional weight of the interest to be served against the dangers of intrusion on the authority and functions of the executive branch to determine whether former presidents were entitled to civil immunity from private damage suits based on their official acts. The court determined that legitimate concerns about countless civil suits stemming from the difficult decisions a president must make risk distracting the president from his public duties, while the public interest in such suits was comparatively weak. In that context, the balancing test came out in favor of civil immunity. Tellingly, none of the nine justices in Fitzgerald thought that the balancing test would come out the same way for a criminal prosecution. And yet today, the majority insists that it does. That conclusion is utterly indefensible. Consider first the danger of intrusion on the executive branch. Or as the majority puts it, the danger, quote, that the president would be chilled from taking the bold and unhesitating action required of an independent executive, close quote. The majority says that danger is greater in the context of a criminal prosecution than it was in the Fitzgerald context of civil damages liability. Think about that. That makes no sense. A former president will face at most one federal criminal prosecution for each criminal offense allegedly committed while in office, as opposed to countless, if not thousands, perhaps millions of civil suits brought by private litigants. More importantly, federal criminal prosecutions have robust procedural safeguards not found in civil suits. Justice Department policy limits the prosecutions that can be brought in the first place against former presidents. And then the grand jury, the petit jury, and judges provide additional checks. The government will have the burden to prove every element of the alleged crimes beyond a reasonable doubt, and a former president may well have legal arguments in defense that would be unavailable to the average criminal defendant. Finally, every president will have the right to appeal, and if past practice and likely future practice is any indication, presidents will be assured final review in this court. Despite these safeguards, the majority insists that the threat of criminal sanctions if, quote, more likely to distort presidential decision-making than the potential payment of civil damages, close quote. If that is right, because every president till today thought they had no immunity, then that distortion has been shaping presidential decision-making since the earliest days of the Republic. And we should be wary of dispensing with it now. It does not seem too much to ask that the person who must, according to the dictates of the Constitution, quote, take care that the laws be faithfully executed, also take care to comply with those laws. Ironic, isn't it? The man in charge of enforcing laws can now just break them. A well-founded federal criminal prosecution simply does not pose a serious danger to the functioning of the executive branch. It hasn't for over 200 and close to 250 years. On the other side of the ledger, the public interest in a federal criminal prosecution of a former president is much greater than the public interest in civil suits. Every member of the Nixon versus Fitzgerald court explicitly recognized this. Unlike a civil suit, a criminal prosecution seeks to redress a wrong to the public as a whole. The public interest is particularly strong with regard to officials like judges and prosecutors who are granted some degree of civil immunity because of their duties. This court has recognized time and time again, in all those other cases, that the possibility of criminal liability serves the important function of ensuring that officials exercising power under public trust remain on equal footing with their fellow citizens. Indeed, the public interest in the federal criminal prosecution of a former president alleged to have abused the power of his office, powers given to him by the people, may be greater still. Not to mention the question of federal criminal immunity for a former president involves a countervailing Article II consideration absent in Fitzgerald. Because the executive branch itself has an interest in enforcement of the criminal law, despite an obsessive focus on the independence of the executive, the majority, in fact, diminishes that independence by exalting occupants of the office over the office itself. In short, Fitzgerald does not support the breathtakingly broad criminal immunity that the majority announces today. Eager to make its project seem more modest than it is, the majority offers two concessions. First, it concedes that Trump's impeachment judgment clause argument was wrong. That clause does not require that impeachment and Senate conviction precede a president's criminal prosecution. But rejecting that argument does not make the majority's immunity doctrine any narrower than Trump's. Only the majority's immunity doctrine would continue to protect the former president's official acts from prosecution even after impeachment in the House and conviction in the Senate. Imagine that. Even though the Constitution says a president can be criminally prosecuted, even when a president's conduct is so egregious that he is impeached in the House and convicted by 2/3 majority in the Senate, he still will be entitled to, quote, at least presumptive, close quote, criminal immunity for those acts. The second concession it claims to be making is that a former president still can be prosecuted for his unofficial or private acts. But that was never disputed by anyone. The majority's only contribution in that regard is profoundly unhelpful. It cuts back the private acts prosecutions that can move forward, both by taking the broadest possible view of official acts, defined without regard to motive or intent, and by insisting that official acts cannot even be admitted and examined as evidence in a prosecution for private acts. The majority creates yet again, out of whole cloth, a rule barring the use of official acts as evidence. Make no mistake, the majority has embraced the broadest view of presidential immunity on offer by anyone, any place, except the petitioner in this matter. When the majority applies its new criminal immunity doctrine, it proves to be a one-way ratchet. The only thing it could deem to be clear is that although it's claiming judicial restraint and sending much of the indictment back to the lower courts for parsing, the majority seems to have no trouble saying that Trump is entitled to absolute immunity for any conduct involving his communications with the Justice Department, and it has no trouble saying that all of the conduct involving the Vice President is official conduct. Thus, it is decisive in the direction of ensuring some immunity. Yet when it comes to the most obviously private conduct, such as relying on private attorneys to organize fraudulent slates of electors, the majority is shockingly indecisive. Can't make up its mind. Even in the face of concessions in court to this court that were explicitly to the contrary from Trump's attorneys. Too hard a question, the majority says. Why is it a hard question? I don't know. Do you? Looking beyond the fate of this particular prosecution, the long-term consequences of today's decisions are stark. The court effectively creates a law-free zone around the president, upsetting the status quo that has existed since the founding. This new official acts immunity now lies about like a loaded weapon for any president that wishes to place his own interests, his own political survival, or his own financial gain above the interests of the nation. Orders the Navy SEAL Team 6 to assassinate a political rival? Immune. He's commander in chief. Organizes a military coup to hold on to power? Immune. He's a commander in chief. Read the majority's opinion, and you will find that it offers no response on this score, except to say that the possibility of presidents getting in the habit of prosecuting their predecessor poses a greater, clearer, and more present danger to the nation than a president who rules as a king above the law. I, like the framers of the Constitution, disagree. I end with this. Never in the history of our republic has a president had reason to believe that he would be immune from criminal prosecution if he used the trappings of his office to violate the criminal law. Moving forward, however, all former presidents will be clothed in such immunity. If the occupant of that office misuses official power for personal gain, the criminal law that the rest of us must abide will not provide a backstop. With fear for our democracy, I, along with Justices Kagan and Jackson, dissent.